10-minute speaker is Jamel.
My name is Jamel, and I'm an alcoholic. Good. I'm a little nervous, but I get nervous when I have to say something important, and the things I have to say are very important today. Because I am an alcoholic, and the only reason I'm standing here before you is because Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Starting with this room. March 16th, 2010 is my sobriety date. I crawled in through that door. I heard a message that I don't remember. I was mocus. If you don't know what that word means, you might be mocus. Stick around. All right. That was the only joke I have. But I walked through that door and I heard a message that I don't recall. But what I do recall is that after the message, I was introduced to a guy who bought me a big book, gave me a living sober. I got some other people's phone numbers. I was taken to eat. After that meeting, I went to another meeting, 10 p.m. meeting, and it was suggested, as I probably was told here, to say that my name was Jamel and I was an alcoholic. And ever since that moment, I've been free. Luckily for me, I've been free of the compulsion to drink, but really what I'm free of is the life that I lived from March 15, 2010, all the way back until the very first blackout. So I marked my drinking history from the first blackout, because from that blackout, I needed AA. The reason being is because there were many more to follow. Constant blackouts, constant vomiting, constant not showing up for the things that life had to offer me. Constantly failing myself and the other people around me who so desperately just wanted me to be who I was born to be. And alcohol stood in front of all those things. And so it's very important what I have to say today, because it might save someone else's life. I could tell you about my great career, my great girlfriend, my sometimes great bank account, the great things that I do in this life. But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And on this day, for me, is a very special day. My best friend of my adult life died this past March. And today is his anniversary. He died sober. So when I was asked to speak, I just thought, how remarkable it is that I get to stand here before you, a changed man, thanks to AA, who experienced a friendship that changed as a result of AA. And I'm really grateful. I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous first and foremost. I'm grateful to the Atlantic Group, because when I came in here on that day, there was a structure in place that saved my life. You know, people were holding up signs about sponsorship, this, that, and the other thing. And I was fortunate enough to get involved with a group of people that did the work, you know, the quote-unquote work, which is the steps. You know, the 12 steps saved my life. And but what I want to talk about before I forget, I was mentioning it to someone, is that the 12 steps saved my life. Having a home group saved my life. A sponsor saved my life. Sponsoring men continues to save my life. Service commitments save my life. Fellowship after meetings constantly saves my life. Taking sober trips that I do take, I haven't taken one in a while, but I do take them, save my life. But the one thing that saves me from both drinking and living a miserable life is making phone calls. And so I call three alcoholics every day, not including my sponsor, because I heard once that if I got the strength to call three in a row every day, maybe not in a row, but to call three, that on the day that I wanted to drink or do something that's harmful to me, I would have the strength to call one. And so it takes three just to get to one. And so 10 people I know died last year, and I made phone calls the whole time. And in this year, in my home group, two people lost people that they loved. And I made phone calls because that hurts too. And I can't say more how making calls saves my life And it also helps save someone else's. Because I never know when I call another alcoholic if they're on the way to a drink, to a roof, to jump off of it, to make a mistake that might lead them to drinking or jumping off of roofs. You know, I've been sober long enough that I've seen my friends in this program do that. And so I call people because it helps me and it helps them. And the other thing I do that's very important is I call people back. I don't let voicemails just live in there because I never know whether they just want to shoot the blank or if they need me. So I do that. And I got that out of the way, and that's the only preaching that I'll do, because I'm not sure if people realize in this program how important that phone is. Like, AA started from a conversation, and now we have technology and texting and Facebook. And, you know, my sponsor told me once, one of my early ones, that I could text anyone anything. How you doing? Oh, I'm doing great. But he said if I call, then he can hear my voice whether or not I'm doing fine. So call people. Let people know you're doing well. Let people know you're not doing well. I drank for 12 years straight. It was vicious. You know, the 12 years were very vicious. Mixed into that, there were some great times. None of them good enough that I would trade in my sobriety to go back to it. Because the pain and suffering that I experienced was so great that I actually had to ask for help and take it and stay in a place. For me, that means that I don't ever want to go back because I'm probably going to die. I'm one of those alcoholics that to drink is to die, as it says in the big book, which is one of the most important books on my bookshelf. It's just a masterpiece. It helps me understand why I need you. And it helps me to understand why I need to keep coming back to this program in order not to drink. I could go to my church and talk to people. I could go to any other place where there's a group of people trying to do something that's helpful. But the only place that I can walk into and be completely relieved of the desire to drink is when I'm around another person who knows just how much it sucks to do that over and over again. And if you're in this room and you're not sure whether or not you're an alcoholic, come to another meeting, hear another message, or just keep coming as long as it makes you feel good to do so. And then if on the day it doesn't really feel that good, come on that day and see what happens when you walk out of the door. For me, on a good day and on a bad day, AA always keeps me postured so that I don't have to go back out and drink. I have so many choices today. My life is great because I can choose. I decided whether I was going to wear this shirt or the other shirt, whether I was going to put my shoes in a bag so I could wear boots so I don't slip and fall on the way to the meeting. I had choices. But before this program, I had no choices. And then there's this thing that you do when you do the steps. It's called the promises. And one of my favorites is you will intuitively learn how to deal with situations that used to baffle you. For me, that starts with not drinking during good times, during bad times, during too much time on my hand. And working with another alcoholic allows me the opportunity to do that. In sobriety, I've experienced the most painful of things, and I didn't drink. I've experienced the greatest of things, and I didn't drink. The reason being is because I have a system of things that I do on a daily basis that keep me glued to this program. And I'll say those as my time winds down. What do I do? What does Jamel do? Not what my sponsor does or what my sponsees do or what the people around me do. What is it that I've collected from all these folks that I do to keep me sober? So I wake up in the morning and I pray. I read some AA literature. I meditate. Thanks. I exercise. I call 3 alcoholics a day. I call my sponsor. I have service commitments. I go to meetings. And I don't drink one day at a time. And I don't do this alone. Because I don't have to. Because of you. So thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Ellie.
Hi, my name is Ellie, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Okay. So I got sober May 31st, 2015. I have a sponsor. I've been through the steps. I have a home group. Yeah, I'll just start about like what my drinking was like and what happened to me and what my life is like today. My drinking was very messy and gross. But I loved it. Like I loved alcohol. It was like my, it was the only thing like I really, really, really liked. I always felt that like I was always searching for something. And like when I started to get drunk, I was like, this is the thing that like works for me. I started drinking when I was 18 in college and I was like a party girl. I would go to these frat parties and like arrive like all dressed up with my friends and like my friends would just get like a beer or something and I would head for the kitchen and do like 4 or 5 shots of gin like in a row. And I thought it was normal to drink like that. I really did. I was like, I have a fast metabolism, so I need to like keep it up early. And then I'll just like nurse my drinking with like a beer through the rest of the night. And that's like how I started drinking. Like I really thought that was like a normal thing to do. And it progressed pretty quickly for me. And I didn't even know what was happening to me. I found it kind of disturbing and scary, but it was so fun to drink and get drunk that it was kind of like, I just kind of pushed the feelings down like all the way deep. I started blacking out, pretty regularly and like getting sick everywhere. Like puking became like a regular thing that I would start to manage by bringing plastic bags with me when I went out. Like I always had at least like one plastic bag on me, like, cause like maybe I would need two, like one for me and like one for a friend. So that was a thing I did when I was drinking. I was like always prepared. I had like my toolkit of things that I like needed, like always had a plan of like what to do if I lose my shoes again. But yeah, like, I thought that was normal, like, and my drinking progressed, throughout college. Like, I started blacking out on trains and, like, waking up in different towns and trying to get home with no money and, like, just missing important family events. Like, I missed my sister's high school graduation, and that was, like, the most painful thing. Like, I still get, like, really upset thinking about that, but yeah. Anyway, so the drinking continued because, like I said, it really made me feel awesome, despite all these fun things I got to have as a result of it. And it just got to a point where, like, you know, I graduated from college, and I'm at this point working, and, like, I'm drinking every day alone in my apartment. You know, I started out drinking as, like, a party girl, and by the end of my drinking, like, I'm in a local bar, if I even made it there, and I'm, like, slamming shots of gin alone, like, trying to talk to people, but, like, it's too drunk to really stand, and, like, looking over in the corner, and there's all these, like, ladies, like, having a good time together with friends, and I'm, like, I have no friends, you know? Like, my roommate, even at that point, wasn't what I would really consider a friend. Like, she was, like, my caretaker. She would, like, clean up my vomit and, like, try to help me piece together my night. So it was really like pretty miserable existence. Like I was hungover every day at work. I started missing work. I wasn't really talking to my family and I just felt very alone, like very isolated. You know, but I couldn't stop. Like I had tried to stop drinking for a period of time. Like I went to AA to try to like save a relationship. And I stayed sober for a little while, but like I didn't listen to anything that my sponsor told me to. You know, I basically was there just to like save that relationship. So when I broke up with that boyfriend, obviously, I started drinking again. So I was like right back to where I started. And like my life was just crazy when I was drinking. Like the things I did and said, like I was a violent drunk as well. Like I forgot to mention that. Like I would drink and like in blackouts, like start screaming at people and like start fighting people that worked at bars. Like the poor DJ at this one bar is just like doing his job playing music. And then like I come at him, like punch him in the eye. Like I don't remember, but that's what I did. I was very upset. It's like, it's unbelievable now because like I'm here in AA and I've like had this spiritual experience, but it's like, yeah, that was my life. Like every day it was very dark. Thank you. Yeah. So the last day I drank, was really bad, actually. It was really bad. Like I toward the end of my drink, I started having like these thoughts, like this tiny thought in the back of my head, like, this isn't a good idea, Ellie. Like, this is really not a good idea. But then like I had enough evidence to be like, this is bad. You could die. And, I would do it anyway. I'd be like, well, maybe like, you know, this is like a client function. Like, this will be okay. Like, I can handle it. And, I didn't. And I woke up the next morning and I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. My hair was like 5 inches shorter because like I had so much vomit, like in my hair. It was gross. And, I was like, I'm done. Like, I need help. And, I went back to AA and I really was defeated. Like, I couldn't look people in the eye. Like, not just in AA, like in life. Like, I couldn't make eye contact with anyone, not at work or like my personal life. And so I just like listened to what people had to say. Like, they told me to get a sponsor. And, so I did that. I called someone and she was thrilled to offer me sponsorship, which I was shocked. I was like, you don't even know me. And okay. Like, I was like, all right, great. I have a sponsor. And, she told me what to do. Like, she told me to get a home group and to get service commitments and to go to a meeting every day for 90 days and to meet with her to read from the big book and go through the steps. And I was like, okay. So we started doing that. We did exactly that. Like, I got service commitments and I started going to fellowship a couple times a week. And like, and my life really started to change like pretty quickly. Like going through the steps, I felt like this was the first time like I really was able to do something about it. Like understand like what was wrong with me my whole life. Like, why did I keep doing what I was doing? Like, why could I not stop drinking? And like, why did I keep starting every time I said I was going to stop? And then like, as I started to change by going through the steps, like I saw that like, you know, I had a life worth living, that like I wasn't ready to die, which was like a really big thing for me. Like, I really wanted to die every time I was drinking. And like, I was like, oh my God, I don't want to die anymore. Like, this is pretty cool. yeah. And like, I started making friends in AA. That was also like, a really big thing for me. Like, I did so much drinking alone. I never thought I was like a friend person. Like, I never thought I would have real friends. And I thought that was kind of for other people or like on TV, that I wasn't real, but it is real. yeah. And I like learned how to be a friend here. Yeah, I mean, like, the process of going through the steps was really cool. It was just, I was shocked that this person who's my sponsor was like meeting with me every week. And like, she was unlike any friend I had ever had. Like, she showed up on time and she was prepared and she had the book and we like did the work together. And like, she listened to me for my fifth step. I mean, it was just like incredible, the whole thing. And like, I got through it. And, when I got to the 12th step, I just like couldn't believe that I was through the steps. Like, it was like a miracle. I'm just so grateful today to be sober, like, that I don't have the desire to drink. Like, it's just been like removed from me, which is really cool considering like I couldn't make it a day without being blacked out when I was drinking. And like, today the thought doesn't even occur. And like, if it does, I have so many people to call and like things to do to protect my sobriety. Like, I have this relationship with my family today that has improved so much from where it was before. Thank you. It's just incredible. Like, I talk to my family regularly. I'm not like the black sheep anymore. I don't like show up to family events like blacked out or puking or not at all. So it's just like, life is so good. I'm useful in a way I never thought I would be able to. And, I owe it to this program. So thank you.
My sponsor's name is Kevin H. I'm a member of the Atlanta group, and I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And I was the overall chair of the Atlanta group in 2003, so I'm finally rotating off of the steering committee. Technically, we rotate off after, I think, about 11 years, but it's been 14 years because people move, people leave the group. We actually lit a few candles tonight for Becca, who was a member of the steering committee my late wife, Allie, and Van, who was a member of the steering committee, and then for Cynthia's mom as well, who's sick, and she's in our prayers. So in 2003, when I chaired the group, there was a fellow who had been coming to the group in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and one day I came to the group, and they said that he had passed away. And so I got up at the end of the meeting. As a custom at the meeting, I made the announcement that he passed away and that he was a cherished member of AA, and we did a moment of silence. 5 minutes later, someone came up and said, "Guess who I just got off the phone with?" John R. And John R. isn't here tonight, but he usually sits in the front row. And what I did is I actually got him to speak the first week. The next week is a 10-minute speaker. So, I mean, some wacky stuff happens to me, but I really do love this group. I've been here since the very beginning, and Peggy and Van did a great job starting this group, and I love it. Sometimes a newer person who didn't know Van will get up to the microphone and thank Peggy and Van. And what people don't realize, Van was kind of a surly guy. I don't want to say he was grouchy, but he absolutely loved this group. But he was, sometimes it was difficult to interact with. He would help you, but he would always like make sure that you knew, you know, where you were coming from before giving that help. And Peggy and I go way back. Peggy, I think, is the longest running thread of my sobriety. I've been sober for 26 years, and Peggy has been part of that for a long time. And in a couple months, when Peggy gets up and gives the group history, she'll say that Atlantic Group didn't arise out of a resentment on a coffee pot. And I actually disagree a bit with that. So I'm going to rewrite history a little right now. What had happened is, when I first got sober, the Big Book wasn't really being used that much. Obviously, it existed. People read it, but people didn't study it the way that we do today. And what happened is, in the early 90s, right after I got sober, people started going to Big Book studies, the Joe and Charlie Big Book studies, and they came back. And so Van and Peggy and a bunch of people, they didn't start it, but there was a Big Book meeting that was Joe and Charlie based. We had like these transparent things with the line numbers, and we would like literally go through it line by line. And it was a really good meeting. It's the first time that I got exposed to the Big Book. And what happened, Bonnie actually went to that meeting too. I don't think she's here tonight, but there are a handful of original members of the Atlantic Group that went to that meeting. And what happened is they decided to make it an open meeting, and that was pretty contentious. And what they decided is that only alcoholics could share at it. And as time went on, though, everybody was sharing. And there are a lot of spiritual illnesses, gambling, eating disorders that are very close cousins of AA. And the solution is the same, but the disease isn't the same. And so it kind of became a weird meeting in a sense, because people were sharing about the cake in the refrigerator, which is a big deal if you have an eating disorder, but I couldn't relate to that. And so that's about the time that Van and Peggy and a few other people started this group. So, in my opinion, the Atlantic Group grew out of that 50th Street Big Book meeting. And so I didn't come to the first Atlantic Group meeting. I thought it was, I had like the original resentment. I didn't think it was a very good format. I thought 2 10-minute speakers and a 30-minute speaker, like, that's kind of stupid. So a friend of mine was actually the first 10-minute speaker at the first meeting. But I didn't go. I boycotted. And I came to the third meeting, and I've been coming ever since. And so it's been interesting to see how this group has grown since the very beginning. And it doesn't surprise me that the group is what it is today, because at the very beginning they got strong speakers, and that's what really made the group. And just slowly by surely the group grew. And we actually had a period of discontent, I think would be the name for it. After about 3 years, there was an uprising within the group as to whether we should have a steering committee or not. And this was in 1997. And it was a very, very contentious group meeting. Everybody was in the group. And so the vote was had whether to keep the steering committee or disband it. I guess if they disbanded it, I wouldn't be standing here tonight talking as rotating off of it. And the urban legend is that it only passed by one vote. It actually passed by 5 votes. But what's interesting, when that happened, about a third of the group started to split away. And so we were a smaller group at that point, but that's right when the group started to really grow by leaps and bounds. Because we, at that point, we really took a close look at ourselves and we started, I don't think that we didn't adhere to the traditions before, but we really made a concerted effort to adhere to the traditions. And that's why, that's when we started reading the traditions at the beginning of every meeting. One of the things that I think made this group really different in the beginning, and something that we slipped away from, is that when newcomers would announce their day count, we would clap very loudly. And that's kind of something that I'd like to see again, but it's drifted away. And sometimes I turn around and I see people on their cell phones and whatnot. And I think, first off, we have a group conscience that we turn the cell phones off. And one of the best parts of my day is getting to a meeting, turning the cell phone off, and then hopefully forgetting that it's off for a couple hours. But we come here to save our lives. And if we were in like a bus rollover accident and the paramedics came, I don't think any of us, while they're doing triage, is like, well, let me look at this Facebook post. And granted, some people can get away. If a couple people looking at the cell phone is no big deal. But if we all did it, then the meeting would be chaotic. And again, people come here to save their lives, and this is a really important. If I'm trying to save my life, I want to have attention on the meeting itself. So anyway, my drinking, it's difficult it's been a long time since I drank. It's been 26 years, so some of it's foggy, but I think it's difficult to put into words what our stories were, given the fact that my life was very unmanageable when I was drinking. And then I superimposed that with a lot of alcohol. And I was in love with a liquid. I absolutely loved drinking. And one of the things I for a long time, I avoided AA because I knew that AA says stop drinking one day at a time, but the message is really we got to stop altogether. So I couldn't envision life without alcohol because alcohol is my life. I drank a lot. I think a lot of people in this room can identify with that. And it's funny, when I was drinking, they didn't have 18 packs. And that's something that's like, they came in, you either had a 12-pack, which that's like not quite enough, especially if like someone like bums like one or two from you. Or you had a case, and that's like 24, you know, that's a bit ambitious. But to me, like, the 18-pack sounds like that's like the perfect amount. And actually, when I was in college, and this might not be alcoholic, maybe college people do this, but we used to have something we called the tree club, that we'd climb up a tree with a 12-pack, and you couldn't get down from the tree until after you had finished the 12-pack, and it would become like after like five or six in, when people had to relieve themselves, you'd be like trying to like, you know, people above you, and it was kind of crazy. But here's the thing, I look forward to the tree club. I think there are some people that are kind of like the tree club, drinking an old 12-pack, but I really liked it. I drank to satisfy a craving. I didn't drink to get drunk. If it was just a matter of getting drunk, I would have gotten drunk and stopped. I don't have that off switch. Alcohol, even though it's a depressant, has an amphetamine effect on me. And for me, I keep drinking and drinking and drinking. And to the best of my knowledge, I wasn't a person that passed out either. I'd usually wake up in the morning where I intended to end up. I guess I was on automatic pilot. And I was a blackout drinker. And I thought for a long time that that was a problem, that if I just didn't black out, I'd be okay. And at the end of my drinking, I was like blacking out after just like a few drinks sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. And it's interesting. A few years ago, I dated a woman, and I don't have a great picker in this category, but she ended up being an alcoholic. And on her second date, like when she showed up with a breathalyzer in the car, I should have said, maybe this isn't the one for me. But so it was, we were dating in the month of December, and it was like one of those, like, it was unseasonably warm. It was like 70 degrees, and so we had gone out to see music. And she had to stop drinking 12 hours before driving because that's how her interlock device worked on the car. So it was kind of coming down. And so we were sitting out on my terrace, and she was explaining to me, she was buzzed, but I didn't think she was like wrecked. she was explaining to me her blackouts, and she's like, if I just didn't black out, everything would be fine. I said, well, are you blacking out right now? She's like, no, I'm not blacking out. I'm perfectly fine. And so the next morning, I woke up, and I said, do you remember the conversation that we had on the terrace last night? She's like, we were on the terrace last night? Like, so I'm just astounded by the fact that she was in a blackout talking about her blackouts. And that was me, because I would go into mystery hours, and they would just be hours and hours and hours. And I used to term myself a blackout artist, and I'd make light of it, like, I'm going to black hard tonight. And I was blacking out all the time. And our first two speakers spoke about vomiting, so I'm going to pick up where they left off. I'm proud to announce that in the 26 years that I've been sober, I've only vomited two times. And the last time was like about 5 years ago. I was like coming up, and I'm like, I've got to hold this in. But back in the day, I vomited at least a couple times a month. And one time I was like out drinking with people, and I just like opened up my shirt, and I vomited down the shirt. A bag would have helped with that one, I think. Another time, I was in a restaurant, and I felt it coming on. I, like, sat down, stood up, and my friends were like, what's going on? And the pressure was building up. And finally, I just put my hand over my mouth, and, like, and I wasn't on a blackout. I can remember the people sitting at the table, because it hit the table next to, and again, a bag would have helped on that one. And I like the fact that you took two bags, just in case. On my 22nd birthday, I was drinking a shot of alcohol for every year, plus my usual drinking on the side. And I was talking to a young woman, and someone handed me a double shot of 151, so I took it down right up on a bag. Wouldn't have helped in that situation. It just came up too quickly. And another time, I threw open a refrigerator, and I guess that just made sense at the time that I was, and I didn't believe it when people told me. Then obviously I wasn't a blackout for that one, because people used to make things up about me, and they didn't, because I didn't know if it happened or not. But lo and behold, I went over to this guy's house, and he was cleaning out the fridge, because I guess at the time I thought that's what I should do. I used to vomit in my sleep, and that's a scary thing, because a lot of people die that way. They asphyxiate themselves. And I would get the bed spins. And how you get rid of this works. With the bed spins, you put one foot on the floor and the other foot on the headboard, and it stops. So a lot of times I ended up fortunately, I guess I always rolled over whenever that had to happen. And, you know, that's the scary thing about this disease, is that we're not afraid to die. And, you know, all of us suffering from the disease of alcoholism, there are times that taking a drink might make sense to us. And we don't think about the consequences. And it says in the big book, to live a spiritual life or die an alcoholic death are not always easy alternatives to face. And like, we read that sentence like, yeah, spiritual life, alcoholic death, not easy. I mean, the death is final. But we don't take that into consideration. And in the time that I've been sober, I've known lots of people that have passed away. And I think that if we took, you know, members of this group that have been here for a long time, we sat down, we could come up with 50 names like that. And the thing is, that would just be scratching the surface. Joey B. passed away Christmas Eve day. I spoke to him at the meditation meeting in December. You know, a lot of times when people go out, they think that they're going to beat the game. And this is a deadly disease. And, you know, fortunately, there is a solution for it. And for me, and for all of us, I guess, we're fortunate that we were alive when we got here, because most alcoholics go to the death secure in the knowledge that their level of drinking doesn't rise up to what they consider an alcoholic to be. And so I got here, I was alive, and as I said, I avoided this for a long time. I had known for a long time that I was an alcoholic. I was probably about 17 when I realized I was an alcoholic, but it kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you're an alcoholic, you might as well drink like one. And I didn't realize the fatal consequences of it. I didn't realize also that it wasn't even so much the alcohol intake, it was the spiritual illness that was like just running and ruining my life. And so at the first meeting that I went to, I met a guy who's still a friend of mine today, and I always tell this story, but he said that the definition of an alcoholic is someone whose life gets better when they stop drinking. And I kind of nodded. I just wanted to get out of the meeting to tell you the truth. People were asking for my number. I'm like, no. But over time, what I realized is that really isn't a very good definition of an alcoholic, because really what an alcoholic is our lives get worse in many respects when we stop drinking. And a lot of the collateral damage falls by the wayside. Relationships improve. We do a better job at work and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, we're suffering from a spiritual malady. And unless that spiritual malady, and I used to pride myself when I was drinking that I was on an even keel. And, you know, nothing affected me. Well, because I used alcohol to moderate how I felt, and it worked to some degree or another. And so it taught us on the doctor's opinion about being irritable, restless, and discontent. So when I get here, all of a sudden what I had been drowning out for so many years with alcohol, I've got this irritability. I've got this, I'm discontent. I'm not happy. And fortunately for us, is there's a solution. And AA is just, this is the only fatal disease that the sufferer ends up in better shape after they take the cure than before they were diagnosed. But then we're like, well, maybe I don't need AA. Things are getting better. I'm going to move away. But we end up in better shape. And that's a wonderful, I don't know if that promise is in the big book, but it should be. So when I got here, my sponsor said, if you're not working the steps, you're just wrestling between drinks. And fortunately, since I got sober, I haven't gone back out, and I really hope that that stays my story. But I spent, I think, too much time working steps 1, 2, and 3. I was trying to get my head around it. I was trying to figure it out. Trying to find God with our head is like trying to drive a BMW to the moon. Like, it's just not happening. This is something that we've got to feel. It's not something that we can just read in a book or go to a 28-day rehab. And the steps lay out a way to find that connection. And if you're sitting here tonight, you've probably worked steps 1, 2, and 3 without even knowing it. And an analogy that I use sometimes is, if I had a headache and I had never heard of aspirin, and someone came and said, well, there's this stuff called aspirin. If you take an aspirin, the headache will likely go away. Well, that's the steps right there. I know I have a problem. I've got the headache. The people in AA are saying there is a solution, that this aspirin may, it's worked for me. Maybe it will work for you. And then the third is, I decided that I'm going to take the aspirin and see what happens. And it's not until I take the aspirin, which is like going through the steps and having that experience. But I think by sitting here, we all acknowledge that there is a problem and that there probably is a solution here. So that's steps 1, 2, and 3. And then eventually, as we work the steps, we get to get that connection with a God. And what generally happens is, when we come into AA, things initially get better. They might plateau, but invariably, things take a turn for the worse, because this is living life. No one says in the book that we're going to walk on the sunny side of the street all the time. Life happens. And with the steps, what I get to do is I get to address the spiritual illness. And sometimes in AA, we talk about the spiritual illness like we're the only people that are afflicted with a spiritual illness. And fact of the matter is everybody, to one degree or another, has spiritual illness. The difference between us and people that aren't alcoholics, for us, we're going to try and cure that spiritual malady with taking a drink. If things are good, I want to drink. And if things are bad, I want to drink. So for me, I've got to address the spiritual malady. Other people out in society, they have spiritual illness, and they deal with it how they deal with it. But for them, the chances are they're not going to turn to something that's deadly to try and cure that disease, that spiritual illness. And in many respects, alcohol is a cure for alcoholism, because the alcohol does initially quiet the mind, stops the voices. The thing is, though, it has really bad side effects. It may be a cure, but once I pick up a drink, I'm going to go into that physical craving. It will take off, and then I'll get thrown into that cycle and spree and remorse. So alcohol really isn't a cure for alcoholism. And what we learn here is that the only thing is it's a God that can save us. And I'm a big step two proponent because I think really all that we're dealing with is step two, because step two is that insane thought or the lack of a thought that we can drink safely. And standing here, I've been active in AA the entire time, but there are times that taking a drink makes perfect sense to me. I don't act on it. And if you're new, it says in the promises that we're seldom tempted by alcohol. It doesn't say that we're never tempted by alcohol. But if you're new, the promises, at least for me, there's only been one time since I've been sober that I was really crawling out of my skin for a drink. And you know what? I did what Jamel talked about. I took the action and I didn't drink. That's one time that I just was like dying to drink. That's not to say that my mind doesn't go there. Like, it would be nice to have a gin and tonic on a nice spring day on Second Avenue, but I just don't do that. And so, as I might have said this, I might not, because I'm kind of losing my train of thought, but the Sandy Beach, who I really admired, he died when he had almost 50 years of sobriety. He actually died in an AA meeting, which is probably the way that he would have wanted to go. He used to say that the disease of alcoholism is most dangerous when we're sober. And I think he's really right, because it's when we're stone cold sober that we have that thought that we can drink again. Once we pick up, the alcohol is going to take you where the alcohol is going to take you, but it's that thought, what am I thinking? And if you know me well and you ever come back from a slip, I'll ask you what you were thinking. You know, I had a sponsee who used to go out drinking all the time, and he'd go into a liquor store, and I'm like, well, what were you thinking? He's like, oh, strange mental blank thought. I'm like, well, wait a second. You had to have been thinking something when you, like, took the money out of your pocket and bought the bottle. And I think that when Bill Wilson and the people were writing the big book, they took artistic license in describing the alcoholic insanity, because most people will not want to admit what they were actually thinking when they pick up, because it's an insane thought. And that's, I started to say that this is all about the second step. I want to avoid that point when I'm on the beach and I reach into the cooler to get a Diet Coke and I pull out a Bud. And it's like, well, it's a hot summer day, and have that insane moment. So we do a lot of overkill protecting against that moment, but it's not overkill because, as I said before, our lives get a lot better because of it. And the third step is, it's all about the second step, but the third step is really where we've got to be rooted, knowing that we got to seek out this conscious contact, and it says in the book that we had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we performed his work and stuck close to him. It's not just my problem. I think everybody, we want to go for the safety. We want the black or the white. And what we realize in AA is a lot of times that we're in the gray area. And that's where letting go really comes into play. And you have the person that lets go at the top of the cliff, that's falling from the cliff. And that person, they're thinking about falling to the ground. And I think a lot of times in AA, what we're doing is we're perpetually falling, but we're taking care of. And what we need to realize is that we're not going to hit the ground, that we're going to be provided for no matter what. I absolutely believe that God is always providing for me. And the only time that we can have a conscious contact with God is at this very moment. It doesn't matter if I was spiritual 2 months ago. Right now is when I've got to have that conscious contact. And the contact with God, coming from God's end, is always perfect. And it's pretty much close to perfect coming from our end as well, but we've got to take a close look at what are some of the things that are blocking us off from God's will. And I think that's where step four is, like, it's a great thing to, you see it, if you're new, you see it on the fourth step that we take an inventory, and then in the fifth step we admit it to someone. But what we get to do is we get to see how our perspective on things, our reaction to things, poisons our relationship with other people. And we're always going to be reacting to things. And I've got to learn that when I have a reaction, a lot of times there's self-centered fear that's involved with that, and that there's a character defect underlying that. And what is a defect that if I ask God to remove, that I could live well amongst my fellows? And it's just an amazing, we really have a gift here that we get to live this spiritual life. And I sometimes I call it rubber hits the road sobriety. Like the guys, I say guys because it was mostly men that wrote this book. They realized that we were like living life. It's, you know, it says that these things are going to crop up again. And what we get to do in AA, and as I said, so many people want to live a spiritual life. We get to do something like we're all doing tonight. We get to come to a meeting. And a lot of times when I come to a meeting, I use that as an opportunity to take my spiritual temperature. Like, how am I doing with my relationship with God? And I love hearing people. I love especially hearing new people talking about their discovery that they've had with their spirituality. And this is something that is always growing. And yes, I've been sober more than 25 years, but I still find AA to be interesting. I still find that there's more spiritual work to do. And I've done a lot of spiritual reading throughout the years, as because that's what it says in AA, go seek. And for the most part, the great spiritual thinkers say, shut off the self-obsessed mind. That's what they all say. Quiet the mind and trust that something's taking care of you. And that's what we get to do here. And as I said, life happens. And sometimes I hear people in AA, they say, feelings aren't facts. And I kind of cringe when I hear that, because the feelings are really what matters. I'm never going to drink over the facts. I'm going to drink over the feelings associated with the facts. Like, I have this absurd fear that I'm going to be rendered homeless, which would take a long time to happen, but like, what am I going to do if I was homeless? And the fact of the matter is that if I was rendered homeless, I'd probably be fine. But it's that chatter that goes on in the mind, those storylines I lay on top of. Emotions are a natural thing, but I put storylines on top of it. Those storylines are the spiritual illness usually. And I've got to learn how to change those storylines, accept the emotion, and let the feeling go. But the feelings are vital. That's what we deal with. This is a feeling program. If, as I said before, we can't just go to a 28-day program and expect to be well with self-knowledge. We've got to continually experience this. And it says in the book that we absolutely insist on enjoyment of life. And that's a huge promise. And I've had a lot of fun and sobriety up to this point. But I also realize that this is, it's life and death for people. And there's a part in the book that says that in God's hands, our dark past are our strongest asset. With it, we can help others avert misery and death. And that's a huge promise, that I can take things that have happened in the past, even some things, dark things that have happened to me in sobriety, and I can use that to help other people avert misery and death. And there was a guy who used to come to this group. He moved away about 10 years ago, but he came back to a meeting one time, and we were standing out in the courtyard, and he came up to me and said, I really want to thank you for what you said that time. And I'm like, I didn't know what it was, but he said, you saved my life. And I didn't want to ask him what it was, but that's what we get to do here, is we get to save lives. And I'm just going to sum it up real quick. I wanted to talk a bit about Allie, my late wife. She loved this group. She was a member for a long time. And she suffered from cancer, and we went to see a spiritual healer up in Connecticut. And the spiritual healer gave us a prayer that, like, it's what sobriety, what spirituality is all about to me. And the prayer is a very simple prayer, but I say it all the time. God, I don't understand you, but I trust you. Thanks.